know, one thing that really stands out to me is, you know, every year I would get students who were 1 to 2 grade levels behind where they should be at the beginning of the year. You know, they weren't coming with the prerequisite skills that they were supposed to have. And you're told you have to use the curriculum that's, you know, your district has decided to use. And you're supposed to, as a teacher, you're supposed to be able to fill in all those gaps. Well, those gaps grow and grow, you know, every year that these kids get passed along. We have to be honest about that, that we're just not addressing all of the individual needs of our learners. And we really need to make some changes in that regard.
That's Suzanne DeMolly, author, CPA turned educator, advocate, and mom to 3. As a parent, Suzanne fought a nationwide battle against bureaucracy for the simple, common sense idea that children in the back of a classroom should be able to hear their teacher. Now, as a teacher herself, she is speaking loud and clear, fighting public school dysfunction on the inside. Suzanne's book, Can You Hear Me Now?, walks parents and teachers through everything they need to know to make a difference in their local school district and beyond. So grab a seat by the fire as we travel to Baltimore to discuss the decline of the education system and the importance of advocating for a change.
All right, so we'd like to welcome Suzanne to the show. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. So we always start off with an introduction. Could you give us a little bit about you, your family, and your background?
Sure. Well, I recently wrote a book, and it's about public education. And that was based in part on my experience as a teacher and a parent. So I was a teacher in Baltimore County, their public school system, for 7 years. And I got into teaching late in life. I didn't become a teacher until early 40s. And prior to that, I was a CPA. And I have 3 children. And it was really back in 2005 when my middle child, my son Christopher, was diagnosed with an auditory processing deficit. That's kind of what launched me into the education world. I just started doing some research to understand his problem and how I could help him in school. And I just opened Pandora's box and learned about a lot of hearing issues that all children experience in a typical classroom because of poor acoustics and because they have immature neurological hearing abilities. And I at the same time discovered a simple solution: give a teacher a wireless microphone and put some speakers in the room. And research shows that academics and literacy improve and behaviors improve. And so I became this person that went from being a very quiet, timid, ordinary person to be somebody that's going to do something about it. And I started really launching a campaign to educate my local school district about installing this technology in the schools to help kids hear better. And it ended up progressing to really a national campaign. And I spent 4 years of my life doing that, made a lot of progress on getting the wireless microphones in classrooms throughout the country, and became extremely passionate about education and opportunities for children. And I went back to school then in my, like I said, my early 40s, and got a master's degree and became a teacher then. And so, you know, that's kind of what got me into it. And so here I am today, really trying to now speak out on issues about public education and get people to do something about it, to improve the system.
Okay, so you sent us your book, Can You Hear Me Now? And we read it. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned in there, you just mentioned that you went back to school, got your master's, you were extremely excited to become a teacher and you're going to do all these great things, which you did. But down the line, you realized some things were wrong with what was going on in the public education system, right? So can you kind of dive into what you saw as an educator?
Yeah, you know, it was eye-opening. Before I actually got my first permanent teaching position, I had a long-term sub position in a middle school that my oldest child had already finished with. My middle child was currently attending. And so I thought I was very familiar with this school, but I was familiar with it as a parent, not a teacher. And when I went into it from the teaching perspective, it just was very eye-opening about just the struggles that teachers go through with being given a curriculum that they find flaws in, but yet they're told to use, about all the testing that needed to take place, the standardized testing and you know, the all the other testing that goes with it. It was just very eye-opening from a very different perspective. And I really saw the bureaucracy from also a very different side. So as a parent advocate, you know, I had been battling all those levels of bureaucracy to get an idea from the bottom layer of the education pyramid up to the top. And now here I was a teacher, and I was very close to that bottom, but I was having all these policies and practices that are being decided by people at the top level being pushed down, you know, and that I was being told I had to use. And, you know, I realized that the people making, a lot of times the people making those policies either have never worked in a classroom or haven't been there for a very long time. And, you know, a one size fits all policy just doesn't always work. And I saw that, you know, teachers and administrators in the schools just have very little autonomy at times of what they can do, you know, how they can apply those policies given their student populations and their community support and things like that. So yeah, it was just it was eye-opening. I ended up getting my permanent teaching position in a school that when I started there, it was just declared a National Blue Ribbon School. And that was in September, 2012. I resigned in July, 2019. And so in that 7-year period, I saw this school go from a blue ribbon school, a National Blue Ribbon School, to one that was really just falling apart. Academically, only roughly a quarter of our students were proficient in reading and math. Behaviors were just all over the place, from you know, basic defiance and eloping to I had a student who lit the bathroom trash can on fire twice. You know, just really like I encountered a lot of problems. The school became a Title I school. We had a lot of shifts in student population and the socioeconomics of the community. And it just, you know, I believe I talk about in my book a lot, my experience in this school, because I believe it's representative of a national trend in our public education system. And I'm just very concerned if we don't start honestly and courageously, you know, addressing these issues and doing something about them, that eventually the people who, you know, have other choices, either to homeschool or do private school, you know, send their kids to private school, will choose those options. And then we'll only have left in the system the children who didn't have another choice. And that's not the way it should be.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very familiar with all that too, as we were speaking before, because all I ever worked when I was working as a nurse, I was not a teacher, but I was in the Title I schools, and they try, you know, it's like a mix. There's mixed feelings. You know, I was in Title I schools where they were trying to pump a ton of resources into that school, but then some things just did not make sense. And a lot of times it was because, like you said, those higher up just didn't get it, just didn't get what it's truly like to be in the trenches of the classroom.
Right.
And then that would create issues, and, you know, the teachers trying to speak up and say, you know, this would work better, but then their voices aren't being heard. And
sure. And, you know, one thing that really stands out to me is, you know, every year I would get students who were 1 to 2 grade levels behind where they should be at the beginning of the year. You know, they weren't coming with the prerequisite skills that they were supposed to have. And you're told you have to use the curriculum that's, you know, your district has decided to use. And you're supposed to, as a teacher, you're supposed to be able to fill in all those gaps. Well, those gaps grow and grow, you know, every year that these kids get passed along. We have to be honest about that, that we're just not addressing all of the individual needs of our learners. And we really need to make some changes in that regard.
So you mentioned that the school was a blue ribbon school, and stop me if I get this wrong from what I read in your book. The reason that it becomes a blue ribbon school is a lot has to do with the standardized testing scores.
Yeah, that's part of it. That's one of the major components. That's correct. And at the time that my school was named a blue ribbon school, I worked in the state of Maryland, and Maryland had adopted the Common Core standards. In 2012, the Maryland schools hadn't yet started using those standards. and we were still using the Maryland state assessment that had been, which was the standardized test used to measure proficiency before Common Core. So I saw when I first started in the school that I was at, I actually administered that test, the MSA test, and my school really went above and beyond to prepare students for that test. I mean, they had quote unquote voluntary four school sessions where we would review questions for the test. You know, they weren't doing anything unethical. It was fine that what they were doing. They were using old, you know, practice test booklets and things like that. But they spent a lot of time preparing kids for that test. And the questions, really, as long as you were preparing them, it wasn't that difficult, I saw, for kids to score proficient when really their ability levels, I would say, were not at that same level. So once, you know, so I think when they earned that National Blue Ribbon status, it was a little easier to earn, I guess is what I'm trying to say. After we adopted Common Core and we started then, you know, using the PARC test, that was much, much more difficult. You could not teach to that test. It was, you know, very difficult questions. And the scores reflected that, you know, yes, our students really aren't proficient in reading and math.
Mm. So was this, I remember reading in your book, you mentioned something that the students were routinely given brief constructed response questions. Is that what you're referencing?
Yeah, well, that's actually, so the BCR questions, yeah. Those related to unit tests.
Okay.
So, you know, the students would take unit tests in reading and math where they would have a BCR, which is a brief constructed response. And they basically have to write like a paragraph or something to explain their answer. And that's the school that I was at, you know, spent a lot of time, again, just teaching kids what to write on those BCR questions that would be coming up on the unit test. You know, we were definitely teaching to the test. The kids would, you know, part of their classroom instruction was the teacher would give a model of here's how to answer this type of BCR, which coincidentally looked exactly like a BCR on an upcoming unit test. Mm-hmm. And then the kids would practice, you know, several times how to write that same type of answer. And then before a unit test, the kids would get a review that coincidentally looked a lot like the unit test. In fact, the questions would be in the same order and just numbers were changed or names were changed. But we just weren't, you know, we weren't really measuring whether a student could read a question and interpret what was being asked and then really come up with their own thoughts using this knowledge and skills they have to be able to answer it. They were regurgitating information, I felt like.
Right.
Which is what a lot of school ends up being, mm-hmm. is regurgitation, which is a terrible way to learn. So yeah. What impact do you think this had on the kids, and why is the school so set on doing this? What benefit was there for the school to make sure that these kids' scores were high, even though they weren't really learning?
Well, the benefit for the school is kids earn good grades on unit tests and then parents are happy. And then that transfers into good grades on report cards and parents are happy. And at the time, like I said, we were using the MSA test, which, you know, the unit test, I think based on the MSA review booklets I saw, you know, the questions were very similar. And so they would score well on the standardized testing. And so then everybody's happy because those scores are looked at heavily by, you know, our administrators, our boards of education and things like that. So it was keeping a lot of people happy, except I would say, you know, it wasn't keeping me happy as a teacher because that was my first year of teaching. And that isn't why I went into teaching. I think the kids are less engaged in instruction when all they're doing is practicing writing the same thing that they see on a screen that the teacher wrote. I think kids deserve more than that. And I don't think we're preparing kids for the real world in situations like that, you know, because in the real world, on a daily basis, whether it's just in life or in your job, you're encountering problems that you know, you've never encountered before. And you have to be able to think flexibly and fluidly and apply maybe something from the past that you did that was successful to help you solve this problem. But, you know, I just don't think it was really preparing kids adequately. And I will say, like, when Maryland adopted Common Core, that kind of teaching to the test just really went out the window. Because, you know, really the Common Core standards were very rigorous and the curriculum was really focused on conceptual understanding. So kids really, they couldn't just always choose C or B, you know, they really had to understand what the question was asking and be able to explain and justify their reasoning. So that did change a lot.
So then what happened then with Common Core? Did you still see a lot of struggle, even though now they weren't teaching to the test?
I think that, you know, Common Core presented some other problems.
Yeah.
Nothing is perfect, but it was implemented very poorly, rolled out just horribly. And, you know, teachers were literally told, here's your new standards. And the district hadn't come up yet with a new curriculum that aligned to the standards. They were sort of writing the curriculum, you know, concurrently with the year. And so in many cases, you didn't even know, like, well, what am I going to be teaching 2 months from now? Because it hasn't been written yet, you know? And the parents were just left in the dark with it, you know, parents, especially with the math, it was just such a new way of teaching and understanding and very different from even the way, you know, I learned it, or even the way of like my oldest child, who's now 25 years old, you know, very different than the way she learned it when she was in school. So parents were frustrated because they couldn't help their kids at home. They didn't understand it. And, you know, there were a lot of things about Common Core, again, that I did like. I liked that trying to get at that deeper understanding, but it was also very difficult for kids who struggled in school, you know, to teach them 4 ways to solve a multiplication problem is really, really hard for kids who struggle with number sense. Mm-hmm. And they don't, you know, some kids really struggled with, well, I don't even know when to use multiplication versus subtraction or addition. And now she's showing me 4 different ways. And then I learned 4 different ways to subtract and add too. So, you know, it was a lot for some kids. And again, that goes back to this one size fits all that just doesn't always work.
Well, in your book, because this brings me to, I'm not sure how the gap, if the Common Core fixes the gaps, which I think I know the answer, but you quoted a study in your book from Butler and Nissan that stated grades may encourage an emphasis on quantitative aspects of learning, depress creativity, foster fear of failure, and undermine interest. So what are your thoughts on grading a student in its current form?
I do think there needs to be some measure of, you know, are the kids understanding? Is the teacher teaching right? You know, there has to be some sort of measure and accountability. But I think that in many cases, we've taken grades just way too far. It does put a lot of pressure on the students and the teachers. And it also depends what you're using. You know, I think we need to really look at carefully, what are we using to determine those grades? You know, if you're looking at just a unit test or just a test that a child's taking on a computer or something. First of all, when they're taking that test, you're losing instruction time. So if you're giving a lot of tests throughout the year, that's taking away from instructional days. It also may present issues with having to prepare kids for the test in terms of like when tests are taken on the computer, you do have to prepare kids for how to answer, you know, use the computer to answer the questions. And again, you're losing instruction time. You know, the funny thing about grades is that we spend a lot of time giving kids things to do that are going to be graded. Teachers spend a lot of time grading. And yet what I have seen is that, you know, yes, those grades get reported on a report card, but then I had lots of kids who were failing that were still pushed on. So kind of what's the point of the grade if we don't really consider it in determining whether or not a student is ready to move forward or not? So that to me is a really, really huge issue. I think, you know, what you brought up about the one study, you know, there's other ways we can measure whether or not a student's understanding and other ways that we can give feedback to students. And I think descriptive feedback, which I know was talked about as part of that study, is in many cases more helpful to the student than, you know, a student gives back a test or something and it has a C on it and they see a fraction. Well, first of all, I learned a lot of my fourth graders had no clue what that fraction meant. Like they really didn't understand that it was saying, oh, you know, you got 14 out of 20 correct. They didn't understand what it meant. You know, what I liked doing, and I did it as often as possible, is like pulling kids in small group, giving them back something that I had graded, but then really talking to them, like going through the questions they got wrong. And, you know, really talking to them about you did this great, you know, but here's where, you know, there was a problem. And what do you think you could do differently next time? So I think that kind of descriptive feedback, whether it's written or just verbal, can be more beneficial than a number on a paper.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had that conversation before that we don't grade in our homeschool, not until probably the high school years, but I've always said that, you know, the negative part of grading is when the teacher doesn't give feedback to the kid, because then how do they learn? Like they right. no longer know what they got wrong and what can they do next time to get it right? Or the feedback is so important, because then what is the point?
Exactly.
What is the point?
Exactly.
Besides, in the end, it's going to negatively impact that kid where all he sees is the C. Instead, right. like, I love what you did to encourage and say, hey, you did great in these areas, but these are the things that you got wrong. And this is what we can do to like learn more about that and work on it next time. I also get that teachers have a lot on their plate too, which is a big problem as well. I'm sure for them to take that time, I'm sure that took a lot of time out of your day to go over things that they missed on their tests.
Yeah. And you're right. And that is part of the problem, is that teachers are under so much pressure to adhere to these curriculum pacing guidelines. And, you know, and that says like, oh, I'm supposed to be done unit one in 20 days. But guess what? Like what I'm told the kids should come in knowing on that first day of unit one, my kids never learned. So I have to go back and try to, you know, fill in what they should have learned last year, and in some cases even the year before that, and you know, get them to a point where I can even start with that first unit. So it really does, there is a lot of pressure on teachers, and particularly when we keep moving these kids forward and they're not coming with the skills that they should have. But I also really want to just point out what you said about you don't grade homeschooling, you don't grade until high school. And I do think in the elementary years, we could have less of the grades and more of that type of descriptive feedback to kids.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to read something out of your books. I think this is really interesting as well. You said schools today are no longer just a place for instruction. The teacher now has the additional responsibility for teaching children social skills and helping them with their emotional needs. The teacher now takes on the role of parent, social worker, and psychiatrist, along with the expectation to teach a rigorous curriculum, often above the ability level of the student. So a lot of people always ask about homeschooling, you know, how do you get done so quick? Like, we're, you know, you can be done with the school day by noon, you know, or earlier sometimes. We're parenting, obviously, and she's the one at home with them, but, you know, you're still parenting, but you're parenting to 20 or so kids on top of trying to teach them something, right? So how much of your day was spent just dealing with things like this and not actually teaching?
A lot. Well, I don't think I ever sat down and, you know, said, oh, I spent this much time today on these issues going on in my classroom, you know, being the mom or the psychiatrist for the day. But I will say we started using restorative practices in our classroom. We were told that we had to do that. And as part of restorative practices, we had to spend at least 15 minutes a day having these circle meetings So that was 15 minutes I lost in the morning at least. And then we were supposed to have, you know, similar types of meetings or interventions if there was a major behavioral issue that occurred, which that would happen quite frequently. So I'd have to stop instruction again. And then because we had a lot of behavior issues, we were told we couldn't just send our children, our students to the bathroom by themselves because fights would break out in the bathroom. So I had to escort the whole class of 25 to 30 kids to the bathroom. And, you know, if I don't take the kids to the bathroom often enough and someone has an accident, that's going to be on me and I'll have a parent upset about that, understandably. So, you know, I was taking kids to the bathroom 3 times a day and, you know, taking at least 25 kids to the bathroom, I mean, I can try to speed them up as much as possible. That's going to be at least 10 minutes each time. So, you know, so yes, there was a lot of time lost throughout the day dealing with those other types of issues that are not in the teacher description. I would say, and I will say too, when I started at the school in 2012, I didn't have restorative practices. I didn't have to take kids to the bathroom. And I noticed over the 7 years that I was there that, you know, I definitely had less instruction time available, you know, throughout the school day. But I think one study I read said that teachers report losing 2.5 hours a week dealing with behavior issues. And that amounts or translates to about 3 weeks per year. And I can see that because we had a lot of behavior issues in our school and there was a lot of things we had to do to try to prevent behavior issues from happening. And then if they occurred, you know, that took additional time away.
I see that being a problem too, because you have the problem kids, right, that make you do these things. And then you have the kids that are there and they really want to learn, but now they're falling behind in their education because they have to deal with the consequences of this other student, right? Now they have to go on a 15-minute jaunt to the bathroom and not learn because some kid lights a fire in the trash can, right? And that's detrimental to the kids that are there to learn, especially in a place where you taught, where this is their chance, right? If they can get there and learn and get out of there, they have a chance, but then you're getting dragged down by another group of students.
Yes, and that's what upset me the most, honestly, about the behavior issues. It wasn't, you know, that I had to deal with them or that they occurred. It was more the impact that they had on students who were there to learn, you know, and really, like you said, that, you know, a lot of kids that I was working with were coming from disadvantaged homes, and it really was their opportunity for a better life. And, you know, and that was being taken away from them by these other kids.
So another section in your book, it kind of talks on how schools are spending hundreds of millions on providing technology devices for children, which we all know. How do you think that money could be better spent in public education?
And do you agree with every student getting an iPad?
I think that the technology is probably really needed for the high school students to prepare them for when they go to college. And, you know, I have two of my own kids have finished college. They were, you know, they needed a computer to get through college. So, and for the real world too. So I think it's necessary at the high school level. I do not think that every elementary student needs a one-to-one device. You know, I would have preferred as a teacher having maybe 5 really good devices in my classroom that I could have seated near me, that I could rotate kids out of to use when they needed to use it, because they didn't even need a device all the time. In fact, for math, which is what I taught, you know, I really felt like in most cases, a device wasn't helpful to them. It was more helpful to draw things on paper and solve problems that way. So no, I don't think they need one-to-one devices, and it presented a lot of additional monitoring activities for me because I had kids who were searching sites that were inappropriate. And, you know, I had, at one time, I had 26 kids with a screen in front of them, and it is impossible for a teacher to see what's on 26 screens. So I think there's a lot of safety concerns with young kids having a device. I would like to see the money spent instead on reducing class sizes, hiring more teachers, hiring more resource support in the school, like, you know, reading specialists and math specialists, hiring more psychologists and social workers to work in the schools. Because again, a lot of kids are coming with social emotional problems that they need professionals to help with, not a teacher who is just trying to do the best they can to help this child. So I also would like to see teachers get better technology. You know, I mean, I had some crappy technology as a teacher. My first year, you know, my projector wasn't working right. Like it was so blurry that we couldn't see anything. And, you know, fortunately I had one at home from back when I did my hearing advocacy, and I brought in my own projector to use because I was told that the schools didn't have a budget to get me a new projector. You know, and then I had the copier machine that was constantly jamming. And so my thing is, I think teachers would benefit from technology more than elementary aged children. And as far as middle schoolers go, or that kind of middle age group, I think that, you know, you could have devices available in a school that where you don't need one for every child because they're not used all the time. Just have enough so that teachers can sort of sign them out, pull them into the room in a cart and use them when they need to.
I think it was last year, her sister, who's the teacher, I think she called and told us the same thing. She was so frustrated because she spent her entire day trying to fix a projector and couldn't use it. And then subsequently told us that every kid just had been issued an iPad.
Yeah.
And there's no money left.
Yes, I know. And I mean, I always used to joke and say, like, you know, if I want to quit teaching or if I get fired, I could go work for Xerox because I have fixed this copier machine more times. I'm like the expert on knowing how to open it up and find the jam now. So it's true. And like our phone system was so antiquated, and we had three outside phone lines for a school of 800 students. So, you know, trying to make a phone call to a parent, a lot of times I'd end up using my cell phone because it just, like, I couldn't get a phone in the school. So yeah, I think there's just better uses for money. And so I will say when I get people that say to me, oh, we just need to give more money to education, I don't agree with that, because I feel like, yes, money is certainly needed to help with some solutions and it is needed in some areas, but you really have to identify the problem and the source of the problem and make sure the money is going to the right place or it gets wasted.
Just like everywhere.
Right.
All right. So your book is about making public education a better choice. So imagine you could dismantle the current education system and build an entirely new one. What would it look like?
I would give serious thought to getting rid of the K-12 system and having a system that is more individualized and, you know, not, let's say, not putting kids in first, second, third grade, but just putting them in a course that matches their ability level. And they transition to a higher level course, let's say in math, when they're ready to go there, when they've met the proficiency standards at the course below. And so it would be it would be individualized and kind of match their own pace. It would be self-paced rather than having to follow these, you know, these curriculum pacing guides and also allowing them, you know, some kids can move ahead. It's not just for the kids who are struggling. Some kids can move ahead faster. So why hold them back and let them go at their own pace? And, you know, if they're good at math, let them go as far as they can in math and meet their needs in reading if that's their weakness, you know? So I would really try to structure it that way. And I would also build more time into the teacher's day, because I think it's ridiculous that teachers have to spend their personal time to do everything that they need to do to prepare to do their job when they're in the classroom. Mm. I mean, there's no time when you're actually in the school to write a lesson, grade something, communicate to parents. You know, all that is done on your personal time. And not only just, you know, I wouldn't give teachers just more time for that reason, but so they could adequately plan better with other teachers and really talk to the experts. Maybe even, you know, let's say if I'm teaching fourth grade math, I'd love to talk to the sixth grade math teacher and find out, what are you finding are the pitfalls that they're, you know, what skills are they not coming with that you see that you want me to make sure they have so that I can better prepare them for you. So just more planning and preparation time in that regard. And I'd love to see teachers have more time in the day to really get to know their students better. You know, to really be able to have more one-on-one time like actual scheduled meeting times with individual students or small groups of students, not just for academic reasons, but to really get to know that child, other than maybe the 15 minutes you have to eat lunch with a child, you know, mm-hmm. when you do like a lunch bunch or something. So those would be the biggest changes I would make.
Well, I know you said when before we started talking, you said you didn't know a whole lot about homeschooling, but the first part of your plan there is pretty much homeschooling. Just so you
know. there we go. Yeah. Well, maybe I should be a homeschool teacher.
You pretty much described homeschooling. Yeah.
It is. You tailor it to the child, and you go at their level, and they're going to bloom at their pace, and they're going to know what they need to know to be successful. It's absolutely right. I mean, you are exactly... that thinking is exactly why so many of us that can do lead the system, because we do see that that is the better way for a child to learn. Unfortunately, like you said, it's the public system as a whole, if they could adapt that and how they could do it with so many kids. We're seeing more and more like micro schools and like online schools that are adapting that, but then it's not public education, like they still have to pay a fee to go there.
Right.
But it's pretty interesting seeing the up and coming, the new education systems, as far as like private and online, that are coming up with different ideas where they can help teach a group of kids at once, but there still is that cost that goes with it. So.
Right. Yeah. And we need to offer those same advantages to all kids. I mean, because like I said, you know, I saw so many kids I believe education is everyone's opportunity for a better life. But for some of these kids, it's the only thing that they really had that was going to help them. Yeah. So.
Well, I know when she used to work in the school system, those kids would look forward to school because it would be the only time that they weren't getting yelled at, maybe, or the only time that they were getting fed properly.
Right.
And they relied on the school day for those things. The problem with that is it no longer becomes about, it's not all about education anymore. It's like you said, what you were doing, it's the majority of that is just taking care of the kid because their situation at home is not great.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, I think that's part of the reason that education is just really declining, is because we have all these greater needs of the students. Well, we still have, and we put more demands on the teacher, but we still have the same amount of time in the school day. You know, we haven't expanded the time of the school day or the number of school days in a year. So we're trying to cram more into the day. And where is it being taken from? It's taken from instruction. I mean, it just has to. Something has to give. You know, we need to recognize that. I don't know if, you know, the solution is to expand the hours in a school day. I'd like to see getting kids those extra supports outside of school. You know, I think there's other ways that we can bring those supports to kids through the community, maybe through before after school programs, and maybe taking some of that out of the school time, the instruction time.
The last district I had worked for, that was their newest plan, was working, putting a lot of focus on the parents and the community to try to see if they could help fix that, mm-hmm. then it would work their way into the children's lives. Which I don't know how it went, because I was right there at the beginning, but I'd be curious to see if after several years, if they were able to see progress, because it was like setting up little offices in the community where they were helping parents apply for jobs or learn basic skills like typing and being on the computer and how to build a resume. So they're trying to just work with the basics of how do you get a job? How do you stay in a job so that in that way, hopefully brings a more positive effect on your family home, which then the child will be healthier. Because yes, our schools where I was working, that was a safe haven for our children. That's what it was. It was a safe place for them. And many of our kids went home on the weekends with a bag of food because they were the ones that we knew that probably weren't going to get fed over the weekend, sadly. So.
Right. We did the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And you have to meet those basic needs first.
Right. And we can't ignore those needs. I'm definitely not trying to say like, oh, just, you know, go back to teaching reading and math and ignore that these kids need all those extra components. I'm just saying, let's see how we can help get those things that the kids need, maybe in some other ways. Mm-hmm. Take some of the burden off of the schools, because there is just a lot of burden on the schools right now. I mean, here in Baltimore, even when our schools were closed during the pandemic and it was virtual learning, they were still distributing food from the schools, I think several times a week, to make sure that kids were getting fed, because, you know, they realized that kids were used to coming to school to get fed and they weren't going to be in school anymore. So, you know, we do need to find some other ways to help those families out.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause at that point it's no longer a school.
Right.
Yeah. 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 Going beyond what a school is supposed to be doing, really.
Yeah.
And somebody else needs, and it has to be picked up somewhere though, the slack.
Right.
So being that you have seen this side of the system, what are your thoughts on home education, especially with all of our, us being a homeschool podcast?
Well, I will say this, when I heard what, you know, what was happening during COVID and how kids were now just having this online learning, and I saw, you know, in some cases how poorly that was going, or just how it was just hurting the kids, you know, maybe, I'm not trying to discredit the teachers or the administration. I think they were doing the very best they could, mm-hmm. but, you know, kids need more than a computer. And, you know, I said to my husband, if our kids were young and I was the parent in that situation, I would be doing homeschooling at this point, because I think it would be better than, yeah, I would try my best to, you know, to fill their needs. I think homeschooling, you know, it sounds like a lot of my thoughts on education are what you're doing with homeschooling. So obviously I agree with some of the things that you're doing. And I think it probably just depends on the homeschoolers. You know, I don't know if it's always the parents, maybe homeschooling incorporates other people as well.
Sometimes, yeah.
You know, and it probably depends on the student. I know I have three children, and one of my three would have loved homeschooling. And she would have responded to me being the parent and teaching her. My other two, I don't know so much. So yeah, I think it probably just depends on if it's right for you, depending on your family and your students and, you know, your situation.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and yes, as far as like the school at home thing and virtual learning, we try to tell families all the time, this is not homeschooling, by the way, like, don't even try to think that these are right. The same thing, because we couldn't do that either.
Like, yeah.
I could be like, no.
And I would say, like, my, you know, the biggest concern that I would have had, well, two concerns that I would have with homeschooling. And so you can tell me how you address those. But one is socializing kids. You know, what I've come to learn a little bit is that, at least in my area, I've seen signs up where there's like homeschooling networks. And so they meet with other homeschoolers. And so they interact in that way. That would be the one, you know, concern I would want to make sure that I would be filling. And then just, is there a point where you kind of feel like, I don't know how the ages of your children, but will there be a point when you think, maybe I don't know everything about this topic and I should get, you know, somebody who has a degree in chemistry to be teaching this? I don't know if there comes a point in time for that and how you address that situation.
No, those are good points.
I'd like to turn the first question back on you though, since you were a teacher.
Yeah.
But about the socialization, do you think the socialization that the kids get at your school was healthy?
No, I don't. And so in that case, yeah, I would be, if I was the parent, I'd be trying to find another alternative. No, it wasn't healthy. Yeah, I mean, kids were being exposed to adult issues and language and things that they shouldn't have been exposed to. So absolutely not.
Yeah.
And that's how we feel. And when people say that, one of my biggest things is, I look at school socialization. We both went to public schools and our kids used to go to public schools before we started homeschooling, but it's one of the most awkward things that you could do in life is be stuck somewhere where you cannot leave around people you would never normally hang around with, but you have mm-hmm. to,
right.
And you're forced to spend time with these people. And many times they go against everything you believe in, and you're picking things up that you would typically not, if you weren't stuck in this place. And that's how I look at the socialization, as far as, well, if they were in public school with other kids, wouldn't this be better? You just answered that question, right? And that's how we feel too. And yeah. I think we can both say our and to answer your question from our side is we utilize a ton of stuff in the community. So we actually are part of like a co-op where the kids mm-hmm. go to classes, you know, on Fridays with other kids. They're involved with sports. We utilize the park system here. The parks have like naturalists and they run homeschooling classes for homeschooling families here during like when, you know, Wednesdays at noon when nobody else can go. So
the library system has yeah. homeschool classes that we go once a week, and they even partnered with like the local university to get a staff member to help teach STEM classes. Hmm. So there's just so many resources that I told Nathan the other day, I was like, I think our kids are more socialized now than ever before. And myself included, because now that I'm involved with my kids and we're going to all these outings together, then I'm always like mingling with the parents that go to the outings too, as our kids right. are getting to know the other kids, I'm getting to know the parents. And actually we do tell parents that sometimes you have to make sure you don't say yes to too much, because we are really busy, and I'm beginning to wonder if I said yes to too much,
right.
because there are a ton of opportunities. Now it does fall on the parents. So I think, you know, that's the other component, is that the opportunities to socialize are there like tenfold, but it's that parent needs to help bring those kids to those opportunities.
Right.
Definitely, you know,
right.
instead of just staying at home all day. And then the other one, what was the other one?
I don't know what the other one was.
What was the other, the other statement? If it becomes, yes, if you reach a point where right. it's out of your hands, right? So yep. that's what we call outsourcing. Normally that point comes high school, almost always you'll yeah. see it. Because in elementary school and even middle school, you accept that you are learning alongside your child. And we do, and it works. Like I never thought it could work to just be doing it with my children and learning as we go. But it does. And because I'm like reading the information with them and we're doing it together, then I'm like excited and passionate at the same time, because I'm like, oh my gosh, I forgot about all this, or I never learned this. And,
right.
and so it works. And a lot of the curriculum these days also are very good at like, the kid could just take the book too, if they wanted to, if they're an independent worker. Mm-hmm. And the book teaches them everything in there. Like the parent could barely do anything if they didn't want to, because they've just come so far with their curriculum.
Okay.
But yes, you can outsource and utilize classes. So, you know, there's OutSchool now. That's a huge platform that you can look up any subject you want and find teachers that are like privately doing classes online, and you sign them up for that. In high school, there's a lot of co-ops like the one we go to. A lot of the students meet their labs and all those, you know, higher level courses at the co-op. And they're usually parents who did this as part of their career, or they mm-hmm. got their degree in it and they're very familiar with it. Or you have tons of high schoolers that just start, what is that, when they start going to the college classes, they can bridge over mm-hmm. and take college credit courses. And then they meet those requirements at the college level already. So we had the same questions, and like we're doing a home ed series. And then this month is going to be the month where we're bringing on guests talking about homeschooling high school and preparing for college, if that's your choice. And every single one of them is like, you're going to do fine. Like everything that your child's going to need to know, the resources are there. It's all available. And I've never heard somebody, at least I haven't met someone, I'm sure there are parents out there that just throw in the towel and they're like, this is too much. But I've heard all success stories so far. And I don't know if that answers your question, but that's.
No, it does. It does. And like I said, I think it probably depends, just like anything. It depends on who's giving the homeschooling, who's yes. accepting the homeschooling, you know,
yeah,
and maybe the community that you live in, it sounds like as well, because yes. it sounds like you have a lot of other resources within your community.
Absolutely.
To supplement. So, yep. yeah.
Yeah. Cause this guy is not teaching anyone calculus. It's not happening.
Well, that's what I think. Like, you know, I remember when my son took like AP physics, no way that I could help him with that.
Well, luckily her sister is a math teacher. So
there we go.
High school level. So we know where to go for that one.
There you go. Yeah.
All right. So in wrapping it up, what are your hopes for this book?
I am hoping that it gives everyone a clear picture of the problems that we really need to address, and it gives them some guidance on how to go about advocating for change in education. You know, because the second half of my book is really a step-by-step process that they, using my own experience, that they can look at and say, she did this and it worked, and, you know, use that as sort of a model to bring about suggestions and to their boards of education, and really hopefully to get some changes made. Because like I said, there, you know, whether you love homeschooling or you love private school or whatever, there's just some kids who are not, they don't have those other choices. And we need to have a quality public education system. I mean, benefits all of us if we have a good one.
Yes. Yeah. Even though we homeschool, we hope the public education system improves, because that's the community that's going to produce the community that we live in.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. I wanted to say, I really liked your book too, because you're almost like a whistleblower. And I think there needs to be more people like that. Like you called foul for sure. Like you saw things going on that weren't right. I love the part where you brought up the fact that, I forget the position the guy got put in. He'd been a teacher for like a year.
Oh, our superintendent.
Yes. Yeah.
He had been a teacher for 2 years. Yes. There was a 3-year requirement for teaching experience to become a superintendent in Maryland. And our state waived that requirement for him because he didn't need it. And he actually ended up going to prison for, I believe, 6 months because of another issue. Yeah.
Miraculously got waived by the government and got stuck in a high paying position.
No, I mean, that's what's so frustrating, is because, you know, parents and teachers feel like, you know, they can't make changes. They're trying to bring forth problems and ideas, and there's all this bureaucracy to go through. And you're told, well, we can't do that right away because it's get approved by this group and then approved by that group. And yet superintendent just got his experience just waived, you know? Yeah. So they seem to be able to make those modifications when they want.
Yeah, that was interesting. I enjoyed that part.
Yeah, and I don't consider myself a whistleblower. I guess maybe the book is, but I've been asked the question, like, were you nervous about writing this and publishing it? And yes, I was. And, you know, I've been called courageous for it. And I don't see it as courage. I just see it as, it's a responsibility. I just think that we've got to make improvements to the system. We just have to. Hopefully it will lead to something.
Yeah, that's all hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. We'd like to ask this to everybody. If you could hand a book to every new person that you met, what book would it be?
Well, other than mine.
Of course.
It would be The Last Lecture by Randy Pausch. I don't know if you read that, but it's an older book, but it was written by a college professor. I think he was at Carnegie Mellon. And it's customary that professors give something called a last lecture at the end of the year to their students. And it's like a hypothetical, if I were dying, I would want you to know this and impart knowledge on them. Only he actually was dying. He had, I believe it was a prostate cancer, and he did pass away. And his was, you know, he knew that at the time when he gave the lecture. And it's just really, I think it's beneficial for anybody to read, because it's really about what's important in life.
I love that. And then if you knew you could only leave one last piece of wisdom for your children, what would it be?
Do whatever you want. Of course, as we're talking about as adults, choose what you want to do, but make sure you give 100%. If you don't give 100%, you're never going to know. If it fails, you're not going to know if it's because you didn't give enough to it. And then if it does fail and you gave 100%, then you know you really gave it your best and it just didn't work for some reason. So whether it's a relationship or a job, or a career, whatever, just, or school, you know, give 100%.
All right. Last question. Where can people find you and your book?
The book is available on Amazon. And if they go to my website, suzannedemalley.com, they can access the Amazon link through there. They can also contact me or see my social media links on there. Just, they can learn more information about me and my family and the book and the hearing issue as well. I have a lot of information on there about it.
Wonderful. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, for any of our families that may have a child with that, that's great. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. this book is great. And I think you're taking that next step that many others need to be. I know you don't think it's being courageous, but it is. We appreciate that. And we really enjoyed having you on today to discuss that.
Thank you. It's really been fun. It's been a pleasure. And I enjoyed learning about homeschooling. That's right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Suzanne.
Okay. Thanks All a right. lot.
Bye-bye.
We want to thank Suzanne for joining us today. Her encouragement to be the leader in improving the education system is empowering for so many. For any books mentioned in this conversation, as well as curriculum resources from past guests and free downloadable packets, be sure to check out our show notes. Thank you all for joining us around the campfire today, as well as those of you who continue to join us each and every week faithfully. If you have been enjoying our podcast, please be sure to follow us on your podcast app and write a review. We would also love for you to connect with us on social media or just send us an email saying hi or how we can help you. We hope you guys have an amazing week. And as always, let's light a fire they can't put out.